I'm Matt Fischel from the University of Delaware, and today I'll be talking about the impact of sea level rise on arsenic sorption in Phragmites australis root blacks. So a brief overview. First, I'm going to introduce sea level rise in Phragmites, talk about the environmental significance of both these different aspects, and then go into my experiments and what I found, and some conclusions. So sea level rise. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration estimates that in the past 20 years there's been about 2.5 inches of sea level rise, and this is worldwide. So some areas have much more sea level rise than others, especially the mid-Atlantic. So around Delaware and the eastern coast, the mid-Atlantic current is weakening from warmer oceans, and it moves in a gyre. So when it's strong, it pushes a lot of water to the center, but as it's weakening, this water builds up along the coast. So especially along the east coast of the United States, there's going to be a lot of sea level rise. Of course, with warmer water, the molecules expand, and this causes additional rise along with the melting glacial ice sheets. So there's a lot of things that are making sea level rise, but not all of them are tied to a warmer Earth. When groundwater is pumped from areas near the ocean, this can cause land subsidence. So as the sea levels are rising, a lot of coastal areas are also sinking, and especially from glaciation, a lot of areas are sinking from that also. So there's a lot of factors that are causing relative sea level rise. And coastal contamination. Historically, heavy industry was located near coasts or rivers. This was because of the ease of transport, and it was really good for commerce. And a side effect was they were dumping a lot of their pollutants into the water, and it ended up in marshes and buried in these sediments. So unfortunately, sea level rise threatens to destabilize these marsh ecosystems. As the ocean rises, it tends to erode these marshes, and also the influx of seawater can potentially change conditions in the marshes, causing the potential destabilization of contaminants that were once buried in the marshes. So at home in Wilmington, Delaware, we had some of the highest number of tanneries in the U.S., so there's a lot of historic arsenic contamination in the marshes. Which brings us to Phragmites. This is an invasive weed from Eurasia, and it's actually one of the most widely distributed plants on the world. So it's invaded every continent except Antarctica, and it basically replaces native ecosystems of marshes. So in the east, we have a lot of Spartina, which are these short marsh grasses, and you can see in the bottom picture, the Phragmites is basically taking over this ecosystem. So this is important and related to the work we're doing because Spartina, the native grass, has really shallow roots, about 40 centimeters, while Phragmites can have roots 180 centimeters or more, which is about 6 feet. So if you think about all these sediments that are buried, all this arsenic that's deep under all these marsh sediments can actually be sort of mined by this Phragmites as it's searching for other nutrients. And this can make it, once again, bioavailable to the environment. So it's really important to understand how these roots are interacting with contaminants in these deeper layers. So here's a little diagram of arsenic cycling in the environment. You can see arsenite often goes to arsenate in oxic conditions because iron, minerals, and manganese, and bacteria. However, in marsh conditions where there's a lot of reduction, bacteria can actually change arsenate, which is less toxic and less mobile, into arsenite, which is a bad contaminant and very toxic and soluble. So the conditions found in marshes that Phragmites grows in is usually where there's going to be arsenic-3 or arsenite that is toxic and mobile. My hypothesis was to look at how seawater can change the chemistry of arsenic in iron plaques of Phragmites on their roots and thus impact the fate and mobility of arsenic in these wetlands. A little bit on root structure and plaques. So just like every part of a plant, roots need a lot of oxygen. And because they're so deep underground, the plant has to put in a lot of effort to send oxygen down into these roots. And they've developed specialized tissue called parenchyma. And in the rice, you can see the arrow points to these large cells between the epidermis and endodermis. And these are basically holes in the cell where the plant is sending down oxygen into the root. On the right, there's a corn plant. You can see they usually grow in fairly dry conditions, and they don't really have these tissues. And then right here, here's a root with an iron plaque. So these usually form because as the oxygen is being pumped into the roots, it diffuses into the rhizosphere around them, and this can cause the iron found in the soil to actually be oxidized, and it then sticks to the root and forms these plaques. And they're really important in the chemistry of the soil because it's a very aerobic, or it's a very oxic condition and surrounded by very reducing conditions. So here are my experiments. I grew Phragmites hydroponically in these buckets and varied the seawater found in each of them. So I had fresh water, which is the 0% salinity, up to 100%. And then I also modeled one after that represents a storm surge, where it started out as fresh water, and after about 3 days, I changed it to 70% seawater. So this basically mimics what would happen if a freshwater marsh was exposed to a large amount of seawater during a storm surge event. And then I added the iron to form plaques on about 70% of the samples, while the others were non-plaque controls. And then I added the sodium arsenite as a contaminant. As far as analytical techniques, I did DCB extraction on the iron in the roots to see just the total amount of arsenic and iron in the roots. And then at the end, I also ground up the roots, rhizomes, and stems to do total arsenic analysis and other elements. Along the way, I've been taking little samples of the roots and cryosectioning them, which is basically a very thin section of the root under cold conditions, to look at the synchrotron. And you can see the picture is one of the roots at the synchrotron, and you can see the parenchyma. So these were taken throughout the whole experiment. Here's the results from the DCB analysis. And it looks like the plaque didn't really affect the amount of iron on the root, the arsenic on the root, but the 10% seawater had much more arsenic than the rest of the samples. And this looks concerning, but we'll discuss later about the species of arsenic found in these conditions and talk about it more later. And here's the total analysis of the roots. So again, the plaque didn't really impact the amount of arsenic that much, and it looks like the arsenic might just be held in the roots. Of course, they have more because they're sitting in a solution of arsenic, while that not that much was taken up in the stems and leaves because it's all being held in the roots. Here's a synchrotron map. So the clear sample is what it actually looks like. It's a picture. And then on the right, there's a picture of what it looks under the synchrotron. And basically, the brighter areas are higher concentrations of arsenic. So I use these maps to select points for Zane's analysis, which allows you to do speciation of arsenic. Here's some spectra, and the bottom three are standards. So there's the arsenic 3, 5, and 2 standard. And before the saline wash, so this is in fresh water, you can see that this curve right here matches pretty well to the arsenic 3, and that's what it was. It was mostly arsenic 3, which is what I added. And this was with plaque. And then after the 70% seawater was introduced, this structure right here is very similar to the arsenic 2. So it appears that after the saline wash, the arsenic formed arsenic sulfide, which is not surprising since a large amount of salt was introduced into the system along with the iron. So then I noticed that the smaller root sections that I'd cryosectioned had different forms of arsenic than the larger sections. So this gave me the idea that possibly more so than the treatments, that the area of the root that the arsenic was found on could be a lot different just based on where it is in the root. So if you look at this, this is another map, and this is the tip of the root over here, and there's actually something called a root cap, which is where the root is growing. And it can take in a lot of nutrients from here. So I wanted to look at this area because this is could be somewhere where the plant is actually taking up a lot of nutrients and consequently things like arsenic. So if you zoom in, I did all these points sort of in a row to see how the arsenic changed as you move back from the root cap. And that's demonstrated here. So point two, which is basically on the root cap, you can see that it's almost all arsenic 3. And then if you move back to this region right here, there's still a lot of plaque here, and it's mostly about 55% arsenic 2 and the rest arsenic 3. But if you move back in this area, it again turns to arsenic 3. So this is pretty important because the plant can take up a lot of arsenic-3 from the root cap, while if you move a bit back, it's precipitated and not really bioavailable. So again, here are some more results. When I ran the 100% seawater, there was actually no arsenic on the root, so possibly the salts had washed it away, and this is would be interesting to see if the arsenic is actually swept away if there's an influx of seawater, if it's going back into solution. And then the 10% seawater and 25% seawater had predominantly this arsenic-2 sulfide. And then, of course, I found this distribution along the root tip, which was very interesting and unexpected. So a little summary. It does seem that seawater impacts arsenic in plaques, but a lot more research needs to be done to say if this is because the treatments or if it's because of the different root sections. So in future studies, I'm going to look at the horizontal sections of the root, and this will really allow me to see the changes across that. And then also looking at this same experiment with soil to see how a more complex and more similar to the environment system reacts to the same conditions. And there's also a lot of work that can be done with other metals, such as chromium, that are very redox sensitive also. So there's a lot of potential for future work that I'm looking forward to. I'd like to thank my group and especially the NSF-GRFP and all the people that helped me with this project. Any questions? Yep. Okay, yeah, good question. So it was synthetic seawater, and it was just based off of an EPA recipe that they were using for synthetic seawater. So the fresh water even had some salts in it because it was simulated real fresh water, but of course it has some salts in it, and it's just based on the EPA method that they were using.
So there's a reference.
Right. Yep. But of course you can also use real seawater and see how that reacts differently.